Well, it was great to be able to talk about school gardens. And I just wanted to also mention, I don't think it came up, there are some family field trips this summer in June and July, and chance for you and the kids to meet the honeybees or dig for worms in our compost bins or harvest and cook some healthy snack, some plant seedlings and so forth. And there's a garden day camp as well. Week-long camps from June 17th. They run through August 30th. And you can find out some more about that on our website, wpr.org/Larry, or go to wischoolgardens.org, and there's lots of good information on either one of those sites. And this is a great time of the year to do a little foraging, for sure, and it's always great to have Sam Thayer talk with us and be back with us. He's the author of a number of award-winning books on foraging, and he's an all-around naturalist, for that matter. He teaches workshops and lectures around the country. His latest book is Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants That Can Change Your Life. And he joins us from northern Wisconsin. And before I get to him, think about it. What edibles do you look for in the spring? What foraging questions do you have for Sam? You can join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Sam Thayer, welcome back.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
It's always great to have you come by. You still get excited about looking for wild edibles in the spring?
Oh, I get so excited. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's only once a year, and you only get so many springs in your lifetime. So I'm always looking for something new, and I'm always looking for something old. Like, I'm never going to get tired of finding morels.
Yeah, and this is it's kind of a little later season for morels this year, at least in southern Wisconsin, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's late for everything this year. I found my first morels yesterday, and that's probably about a week to 10 days later than I would normally find my first ones.
And are they your favorites, and what other favorites do you have?
Well, as far as spring mushrooms, morel is definitely tops. I mean, there's also the pheasant back, which we consider kind of the consolation prize for an unsuccessful morel hunt. But pheasant back is a very easy mushroom to identify that also comes out in the spring. It's also associated with elm, but it grows as a shelf right on the tree. And if you get them when they're full size, they are not good, in my opinion at least. You need to get them when they're small. And they can get a foot across. So you find them when they're just a few inches across, and they're quite tender, and they're at least reasonably good. They're not as good as a morel.
Someone sent me a photo of that included both pheasant back and morel on the in the earth yet, which probably a little unusual.
Well, you know, a little bit, but normally the first 2 years after an elm tree dies, you see morels near it, well, if you're lucky. And then the pheasant backs show up for like year 3 through 5 or maybe even year 7. So there is some overlap. Sometimes I find them on the same around the same tree.
And morels are not necessarily always around elms, are they?
No. So, you know, dead elms is one of the, you know, most commonly known associations for finding morels. But I look for them under dead butternut trees. I look for them under dense stands of living white ash or with a mixture of dead and living white ash. I look for them around dying or dead hickory trees, old apple orchards, or especially a non-commercial orchards like pasture apple trees. And so old dead apple trees. And it depends on what part of the country you're in. I was in Colorado last May, and we were finding morels under cottonwoods in the floodplains, and that's where everyone said you went to look for morels in central Colorado. So it depends on quite a few things.
It's interesting. I can remember my dentist telling me about one of his clients calling and saying, I've got these mushrooms in my lawn in the backyard, and I don't know what they are. You want to come and take a look? And he said there was like half a bushel of morel mushrooms in her lawn.
I got one of those calls once, somebody asking me to identify mushrooms, and she said, you can have them this time. In the future, they're mine.
There you go. Sam Thayer, our guest, questions for him or maybe an experience to share about your wild edible hunting, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or go ahead and email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, what are your favorite? What are your other favorites for springtime hunting?
Well, you know, spring is the time for shoots and greens, and if I go out foraging like I did all day yesterday, I may or may not come back with morels, but I always can get as many greens as I want, and some of my favorite vegetables in the world. I mean, we pick leeks or ramps, you know, every spring. We have lots of them on our property. Nettle shoots, especially wood nettle, that's one of my absolute favorite. The seeds of Siberian elm are not very well known as an edible. They're peaking right now about mid-state, and they're just like little flat discs with a seed in the middle, and before that disc toughens up, it's just like a tender, slightly sweet, leafy green. It's great as a salad. It's great just to, you know, throw some on a taco or in a burrito, or just to snack on them and feel like a human giraffe. Eat them right off the tree without using your hands. They're delicious.
Oh, I love it. I was thinking about this. I was last week. I was out this past week. I was out with a friend who happens also to be a chef, and we were doing. We were not searching for wild edibles, but he was paying really close attention and. Along the fence line and the sort of the wooded areas. And I said, what the heck are you doing? He said, well, I'm looking for ramps and I'm looking for nettles for his restaurant.
Yeah, you know, we forget sometimes that these wild vegetables they're gourmet, and somewhere in some culture, they're a common cuisine. You know, and we know that wild blueberries are the best and wild raspberries are the best. And sometimes we forget that the leafy greens are also the best. They're fresher. There's a greater variety. And the quality, if they're picked at the perfect time, is generally better than anything you can buy and as good as anything you can grow. And the variety is so great. We have more than 45 good mustard greens growing wild in this state. I mean, that's incredible.
It absolutely is. Well, tell us, before we take any calls here, again, you can join us 800-642-1234. We've talked about incredible wild edibles, 36 plants that can change your life, but that's still a wonderful guidebook. Talk about your book a little bit.
Sure. Well, all three of my books, I try to cover plants in greater detail than a field guide. So you have anywhere from 3 to 20 pages about a plant, giving you the information that you need to feel comfortable actually eating that plant. You know, multiple photographs, a lengthy description. I talk about some of the plants you might confuse it with. I talk about what parts you use and how you know it's at the right stage of growth. Because knowing what an asparagus plant looks like without knowing you eat the shoot, but not the older stems or the berries, isn't going to get you anywhere culinarily. So that's really important. And then I give you some ideas on how I prepare them, how I use them. So that book covers 36 plants. My first book, Forager's Harvest, covers 32. My second book, Nature's Garden, covers 41. And there's no overlap in the plants they cover. It's just I couldn't fit them all into one book.
All right. Well, there you go. And it's nice to have them all. And you have are you still operating your store? How's it going?
Yep. And so I make various products from wild things that I collect. My wife and I make maple syrup. We make birch syrup. We make hickory nut oil. And, you know, we collect and dry some wild mushrooms, and we do some wild jams and jellies. So we have a variety of stuff that we make, and then we have some other items that you might want as a forager that are hard to find. Like, we carry this Dave-built nutcracker, which is awesome for hazelnuts or acorns, stuff like that.
And I had some of your birch syrup, and it is really good, and I don't think anybody, probably most people haven't heard of that, but talk about that birch syrup.
Well, right when I pull my maple taps, I tap the birch that I have. I don't have as many birch as maple. I collect the sap usually more frequently than once a day to try to keep it as fresh as possible. The ratio for birch is about 120 gallons of sap to a gallon of syrup. So it's more labor-intensive, takes more fuel wood than the maple. And birch does not taste anything like maple.
No.
I describe it as if you took apple juice concentrate and added some molasses to it, is kind of how I think of it. I really like it, but I don't like it in the same ways that I like maple syrup. We only make, you know, I think we made about 8 gallons of birch syrup this year. So, you know, we don't make it in nearly the quantity.
And it probably goes in a pretty quick hurry.
Well, yeah, we've been selling out pretty much as long as we've been making the birch. We've been selling out. And we have one friend that also makes birch, and we bought some from her in bulk and bottled that and sold out of that, too. So, yeah, we tend to sell out of it.
So, and just as to keep going on this, how do you decide what to carry in your store?
Well, anything... You know, we carry other products that we don't produce that are wild harvested, and we have a nice little book selection in here that just all sorts of nature books, plant identification books, bird field guides, you know, tree books. We have, you know, home cooking type books. So we kind of we have basically anything that we imagine that the outdoorsy type. The forager, gardener, self-sufficient, sustainability type of person is going to be interested in. That's the kind of stuff we carry.
Yeah, and it's a pretty good selection. Our guest today, Sam Thayer. By the way, Sam, it's your website is forageharvest.com, isn't it?
Yeah, foragersharvest.com.
Foragersharvest.com. Sam Thayer, our guest, he's going to be with us up right up until 12:30 today, as we talk with him about wild spring edibles and about his store and about his book. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We are going to take a quick look at the news, weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we will be back with our guest, Sam Thayer. You stay with us. We'll be back right after the news. You know, there's something very satisfying from finding food in the wild. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest today, Sam Thayer, has been foraging, hunting, camping, and studying nature since he was very young, and now an author, a speaker, and teacher. So it's great to have him with us today to talk about wild spring edibles. And you can join in. Do you need help to identify a wild plant? Do you forage? How has it changed the way you think about food? Join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Sam, we've got an email from Jen in Winona, Minnesota. She says she used to like to pick blackberries and blueberries with her grandparents, and doesn't live in that area anymore, but she is wondering if she could convince the current owner to let her harvest some of the plant. Is there a way to gather some of the stems to plant them where she lives now? She says she isn't very garden savvy, unsure how best to do that or if you can do that.
Well, you know, the first rule of transplanting and tending is make sure you have the right site conditions, because all labor is lost and wasted if you're trying to plant a blueberry which likes generally poor sandy or gravelly soil and acidic soil, and you're planting that on rich soil in, say, moderate shade, and it's just not going to do well. But if you do have the right conditions, things are often very easy to transplant, especially things like blackberries that have a robust root system. It's too broad of a topic to give detailed instructions on, but I would say if you're going to do blackberries, cut all of the top off and just plant the root system. That's an easier way to go than trying to transplant the top. Then you'll be setting yourself back 1 year by timing, but you will have a lot better success in getting those transplants to survive.
Let's go to Ann in Green Bay. Ann, hi.
Hello. I'm just wondering if you consider dandelions and the garlic mustards as part of your edibles?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I ate both yesterday. You know, garlic mustard is a pretty good edible. It's got a strong flavor, not surprisingly. It's a mustard green with the garlic hint to it. And there are a lot of ways to use it that are excellent, and it has been analyzed. It's incredibly nutritious. It's also a serious invasive in our hardwood forests, and so I have a few places that I forage. There are some populations of garlic mustard have showed up, and I am actively involved in eliminating the garlic mustard so I can have all the other spring flora to look at and to eat. And dandelions are great. You know, traditionally they are fried in Mediterranean cooking, and you collect the leaves when the flowers have not yet emerged. You can collect them later. And one hint with dandelions is I use scissors and I snip the terminal half of the leaf, leave that base of the leaf there. It just doesn't taste as good. It's stringier and it's a little more bitter. And take the tip of the leaf, and you'll end up with a lot better greens.
So there you go, Ann. Thanks very much for that call. I was thinking about this just today, and I haven't had a chance to look at the recipes carefully, but someone sent me a recipe for wild violet jelly and also for dandelion jelly. Have you ever made jellies out of those?
I have not made jelly from dandelion, but I have had it and thought it was pretty good. Now, violets are traditionally made into jelly in Europe, but the common European blue violet is aromatic. The flower is.
Yeah.
Our common blue violet is not aromatic, and I have made jelly from the flowers. It's a lot of work to pick a bunch of purple flowers, and the jelly looks pretty, but it tastes like you made it from leaves. It does not have any fruity or aromatic quality to it. So it's pretty, but I probably won't be doing it again because I felt like I just eat the violet flowers by themselves and get all that purple goodness without having to mix sugar with it.
Makes good sense. Well, you can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Alan in Toma next. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I was listening to the show, and I heard the comment about the mushrooms. And about 10 years ago, I had some college courses in how to discover and identify wild edibles, and each course was like a spring course, summer course, fall course, and winter course, so where you could find what was available during those seasons. And the teacher wouldn't even touch mushrooms. They said, well, that's another topic, and I'm not going to have any liability about it, so they wouldn't talk about mushrooms at all. The other thing was that in each of these courses, we had to get about three different field guides. And the pictures were poor. Some were color, some were black and white. And often the picture that showed the best identification for the plant, that was not when you could eat them. So, yes, you could identify them in the fall by their nuts or fruit or whatever, but oftentimes the best time to eat of it, like asparagus, is in the spring. So I was a little bit disappointed that you couldn't, unless you really, really studied and knew what you were doing, you couldn't just walk into the forest and identify plants to eat. you had to pick them out as the seasons came, of course. And one of the recommendations was that if you identify them in the field, bring them home and replant them in a garden so that you can identify them. You know where they are and you know what you're eating.
Yeah. Well, Sam, some of that you take care of in your books, but talk about Alan's comments.
Sure. Well, I hear a little bit of frustration. And to temper that, I would just say that foraging is not something you learn as a piece. You learn it one part at a time. You learn it one plant at a time. And in one sense, I could say it's like learning a language. There's a lot to it. And if you think you're going to get a guidebook to Italian and visit Italy and be able to speak fluently, it's not going to work that way. You have to put in a lot of effort. But the way that it's not like a language is that you can learn one plant, and then you can use that one plant, and you can fully incorporate it into your cooking. And so when you bite it off in little chunks like that, one plant at a time, it's no longer daunting to learn. If you learned 2 a year, after 10 years you know 20, and that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You could know the 20 most common around your area. So it does take some effort to identify. As far as finding the plant at a time when it's easy to identify and then coming back at a later time to identify it, I think that's great. I think it's easier to write down the spot in a notebook and just return to where it's growing in the wild. I think that's more successful and probably less effort than trying to move each plant that you would learn. But I definitely still do that. I mean, I know a lot of wild edibles, but I'm still learning a couple new ones each year. So there is a lot to learn, but you don't have to know it all to use it, is what I would say.
All right. There you go, Alan. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Debbie in Hancock has something for us next. Hi, Debbie.
Hi there. I'd like to go back to garlic mustard.
Sure.
I'd like to know when to harvest it, if you harvest it before it blooms, and how you prepare it.
All right. Okay. Garlic mustard.
Yeah, a lot of people make pesto from garlic mustard leaves, just the leaves, and then you can really do that in the fall. You can do it in early spring, and you can do it really through flowering. That's pretty good, but it's not something I do often. What I really like is the garlic mustard stalks right before they bloom. So I will be collecting those up here. It's right about now. In southern Wisconsin, you probably passed it by 5 or 10 days. But I like to get them right before they bloom. I strip the leaves off, and I chop the top off and discard that a lot of the times. And then you can steam that and then serve it just salt and butter like you would do asparagus. You can use it in a soup. You could use it in a stir fry. And then you have a milder, more toned down flavor without so much of that, both that strong mustardy and the strong garlicky flavor. You just get a little bit of both, and it can be a really pleasant vegetable when it's used that way. But some people accuse me of being picky, and I am. That's why I eat all this wild stuff, because I'm really picky. You can't meet that quality in store-bought produce.
There you go, Debbie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeff in Sparta wonders what your favorite way is to prepare morels.
You know, I have had a lot of things made from morels, but this plain old simple fry them in butter is pretty good. I mean, it's hard to beat that. But the thing about morels is they have such a delicious juice that comes out of them when you cook them that, I mean, you can, if you get enough morels to make, you know, a sauce and cut up some ramp bulbs with it and a couple other good vegetables and then just kind of serve that over wild rice, that's great.
I would agree with you. It is great. And thanks so much for that question, Jeff. Appreciate it. Someone else was wondering about Japanese knotweed again and what you can do with it. Here it is, another invasive.
Yeah, well, Japanese knotweed is sort of a strange vegetable, and it has that tangy flavor like rhubarb, but not quite as fruity, not quite as tangy. Some people make Japanese knotweed pie with those shoots. I don't like it nearly as much as rhubarb pie, and since rhubarb is also abundant, I haven't made that Japanese knotweed pie more than once. If you are going to make something with Japanese knotweed, make sure you peel it, and peel it right away, because the outer skin has an astringency that detracts from the flavor of anything you make with it. I like Japanese knotweed more as a stir-fry vegetable or a soup vegetable that you could put in a soup that doesn't get cooked very long, because it is very tender and it kind of disintegrates. That slight tanginess is really a nice counterpoint to a lot of blander vegetables in like a stir fry or a soup. So, but the key thing is get them when they're young, peel them, and peel them right away. They get harder to peel the longer you wait.
So you pick them and you peel them right on the spot?
I usually actually do pick them, peel them right on the spot. And most often I eat them right on the spot raw. Just one or two stalks are really good. I'm just across the park from where I'm speaking, there's a big patch, and I'm going over there later to get a few shoots. So I'll probably just eat a few raw and then maybe bring a couple home.
Oh, that is amazing. Let's take some more calls. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. Ron in Seneca has something for us, so let's go to Ron. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got several different things I like with marrow mushrooms, but the one thing I like is a homemade pizza. But there's a trick of doing it.
So you make a homemade morel mushroom pizza?
Yes. Make your pizza just like you normally would. You have to use a boughten mix, you know, mix it. Can't use a boughten pizza, frozen one. And what you do is you take and rinse your mushrooms off and then squeeze all the moisture out that you can get.
Mm-hmm.
And then chop them up fine. And you want to just smother the top. The more you got, the better it is. And then just cook it. But you want to put the mushrooms on last so they cook good.
Well,
and you won't want a pizza any other way.
Well, Ron, I have not heard that one before. Sam, have you?
I haven't. That sounds really good. Maybe I'll get to try it. You can't buy that at Little Caesars or Papa John's.
No, you can't. Oh, man, that Ron, you must be extraordinary at getting morel mushrooms.
Well, I used to be. I can't get out and get them anymore.
Oh.
I don't get the chance. I never sold any, and I'd pick 100 pounds a year sometimes, and I'd give everything away I could that I didn't eat.
Oh, man. Well, good for you, Ron. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I had some friends who gave me, a couple of years ago, gave me some morels. They knew I was leaving. They gave them to me as a birthday present. My birthday is May 14th, so it was pretty good timing. And they knew that I was going to be gone for a week or so. So they put them in they sealed them in a vacuum seal and gave them to me. And I had them much later, and they were pretty good, Sam.
Oh, that's good. That's good to know. Yeah. They do keep, if you know, fairly well if they're refrigerated compared to some kinds of mushrooms.
Yeah, yeah.
And happy birthday.
Oh, thanks. Let's see, did we get Christina in Glenwood City? We got Christina there?
Hi there. Hi there. I thank you for taking my call. I've got many burdock plants in my field. And I understand they're edible and you can ferment with them. So I'm wondering when and how to harvest them and what parts are edible.
Okay, well, with burdock, you've got the root and you can harvest the root on, you have a pretty broad season because that plant usually lives 3 years or 4 years before it sends up a stalk. So you can collect it any time that it does not have the stalk coming up. When the stalk comes up, the root will get tough and woody. So you could collect them now or midsummer or fall. And there are three kinds of burdock in Wisconsin. There's woolly burdock, not very common. Common burdock, very common statewide. And great burdock, which is locally abundant. The great burdock has a much better root. It's more tender and it's sweeter. That's the one that's served in Japanese cuisine as gobo. If you have that one, you're in luck, I think. You can also eat the stalks of all those kinds of burdock when they're young. When they're about knee-high is ideal. Cut them at the base and peel the outer layer, and inside you have this kind of, I don't know, it's like a starchy stick of, it's slightly green towards the top and it's white at the base. And you can use that kind of like new potatoes. That's another great vegetable. The time to do that is late May to mid-June, again, when that stalk is about knee-high, way before it's flowered. Those are the two main parts to use on burdock.
And those are pretty good. I also had a friend who I think used to put some Italian-style breadcrumb. He'd make some sort of a deal out with it and then kind of fry them in an oil.
The stalks?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's a whole lot of things you can do with that. The root is a little on the tough side, so I like to grate it or chop it very fine. And the stalk is a little bit easier to use and more tender. And there really is quite a variety of things you can do with that. It's not a strong flavor, so it'll take on the flavor of what you cook it with. And in that sense, it's kind of like a potato, but it's got a sweetness that a potato doesn't have.
Yeah, and I remember that as he was an old Italian guy, and he used those Italian, probably a little egg or whatever. I forget what else he sort of used to get the breadcrumbs to stick. And then he'd do them probably with a little garlic and oil maybe. They were really, really good, I can tell you that. Christina, good luck with that. Thanks a lot for calling. And Gary in northern Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call.
More of a question in regards to pickled asparagus, in that a lot of people have bad experiences with it, and I basically want to try it this year for the first time and maybe just pour the brine over the fresh asparagus. Question for your guest, as his best results for pickled asparagus.
So I have never pickled asparagus, and not only that, I don't think I've ever eaten pickled asparagus.
Oh, I have.
Yeah, so I can't help you with that, but maybe Larry can.
I can't because I've never, I've only eaten it when someone else has pickled it, so it was always very good. And I'm not sure what you do. The problem with it is it can get really kind of mushy almost if you aren't careful. So we're going to have to... And I don't want to give any instructions when I don't know really know the answer. And I don't want to guess is the thing there. Probably, Sam, you don't want to either.
Yeah, yeah. There's got to be some good instructions either in a book or online. But, yeah, I don't know off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'm sorry we can't help you out there, Gary. But thank you so much for calling. You're going to have to go online and do a little searching around. Are you working on any new books now, Sam?
Well, I've actually been working on a field guide for about 10 years for Eastern North America. I don't know what the timeline is for that, maybe another two or three. This sort of the opposite of my books is Identification Key, with about one page per plant, and there's going to be about 530 plants. So
wow, when that comes out. Yeah. And you're doing, you always do a lot of talks and things of that nature. Have you got anything coming up?
Yeah, well, actually, this weekend we have something called the Blue Hills Foragers Gathering up here in Bruce, and we have myself and two other excellent instructors, one coming from Pennsylvania and one from New Mexico, this weekend, and there's going to be cooking workshops, demos, there's going to be a mushroom class, there's going to be some ecology classes, plant ID stuff, so... I have most of the things I have scheduled are full, I believe. I'm doing something at Sandhill Wildlife Area. I tend to do about four or five programs a month through the warm seasons. But if you go to my website, foragersharvest.com, any new things I have will be posted, because I have a few that I'm in the works that haven't been scheduled yet that will get posted on there.
So it's foragersharvest.com, right?
Yep.
And we'll have a link to that on our website as well. If you go to ideas at WPR.org/Larry, we'll have a link to Sam's site as well if you didn't get it down. But again, it's foragers with an S, foragersharvest.com. Sam, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, Larry, and thanks to your listeners.
Sam Thayer, he's got three books out. His latest is called Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants That Can Change Your Life. I did want to say a big thanks to Mineral Point, all the folks at Mineral Point, Wisconsin. We had a wonderful time at the Mineral Point Elementary School yesterday. What a fine bunch of children and teachers as well.